There's a method in my madness, I guess, and it's this. That one of the hardest things for us to examine are the things that we take for granted, day in and day out. And we fail to see a lot of our own prejudices, if we want to call it that, our own biases, the way we structure explanations, the way we say something is reasonable. It's hard for us to examine our own way. And then when we go and we study someone else's way, such as this morning when we were talking about the book of Revelation, and here they were living in an entirely different world, it's very hard for us to accept quite often these people as being reasonable, ordinary human beings speaking to us, because they don't think like we do. So part of a study, and it can be a biblical study or a study of yourself, a study of the culture we're in, the problems we have, is to try and get some grips on some things that we take for granted that other cultures probably didn't. And why do we do that? We have to ask that question. So it's a self-examination. And that's, I think, important every time you're trying to study someone else. You always have to study yourself, too. And it's particularly important in today's day and age because we as a culture are powerful through technology, extremely powerful. And so it's important to examine the character of this power and where it comes from, because there's a lot of power for both good and evil. So I'm going to start out with something that we take for granted, that we tend to accept. And I see a lot of people wearing little devices strapped to their bodies. And this room doesn't have one, but most rooms have these devices looking over. Most people keep these little devices by the sides of their beds. What are these things? What are they? Clocks. Watches. Clocks and watches. What do they do? What does a clock and watch do? I mean, it's every day. I mean, what could be more common than, I don't have one on, but what could be more common than wearing a watch? All right, but what do?
Organize time.
Organize time, or they measure time. They organize, measure time. Okay, everybody happy with that? Now I'm going to behave a little bit like a kid. And adults know that that's where you're supposed to stop the questioning. Kids don't. They say, what's time? So we got some answers? What is time? I mean, what could be more fundamental to our reality than space and time? Okay, I mean, really, we say everything exists in space and time. We have things like that. But now let's start saying, what is time? Anybody have some good ideas?
Resistance?
Well, that's an interesting word. Okay, anybody want to throw out some words? Just throw out some words. You don't have to have definitions.
Measurement.
Increments. How we divide up our experience, our activities. Is time a real thing?
It's relative.
What does it mean when time is relative?
Decay.
What does that mean?
It passes.
It passes. What does that mean? Let's take it passes. What does that mean, time passes?
We'll never have it back.
Never have it back? So it passes from future to past? Yeah, all right, gonna switch around. It passes, wait a minute, it goes from future to, or we go through. Okay.
A non-renewable
commodity, okay? Okay? You can't stop it. Wow. I mean, now just imagine someone from another planet listening to our descriptions of this. I mean, it sounds weird. I mean, here's this thing you can't stop. We measure it. We gear our lives to it. It flows. Flows. That means life goes from future to past. So someone would come up from another culture and say, oh, what's the future? What's the future?
Well,
that's where we're not. What's the past?
That's where we've been.
That's all gone. So existence is living in it's not yet here, or it's gone. Now that's strange. Then how can anything be? Where does anything exist then? In the present. Oh, so nothing exists in the future. That's not yet. And the past is gone, so that's not really present. So what is it? Well, how long is the present?
Moment to moment.
How long's a moment? Has a zero dimension. How can anything exist with a zero dimension? See the kinds of problems we get into, you see? And yet we accept it. Let's go back now, I think, when you reach the stage that maybe this is something that isn't so obvious time. Let's see if we can try kind of an existential critique of it. We'll go back and look at our experience as honestly as we can. Now let's go back to our childhood experiences when we actually learned what time was, and see how we learned it, and then see if we've changed our ways since we were a child. That might be one way of going back and learning. Now, I found, and I'm fortunate, I have two sons. They're out age 13 now, and we've talked about this over the last few years, and it's caused me to go back and think. And kids really come up with, adults are really kind of crazy. I mean, they come up with this. I mean, let me give you an example. Okay, now remember, you're a kid. Now, they're finding out kids are smart. I mean, the idea that kids just, they're simpletons, and that's not true. I mean, they're really pretty bright. They come up with some profound, profound things. They just don't come up with the same ones we do, okay? Okay, now, but from their perspective, we're kind of strange, but of course we're bigger than they are. So we can impose our will a little bit more. But let's take a kid now who really has absolutely no idea. And so the kid sees a clock. Well, this is a pretty fascinating little thing. Pick it up, tick, 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 and these arrows kind of go around on it. And he looks in, and Grandpa has one, an old one, keeps in his pocket. And Mom has one, strapped on here, a nice little tiny one. It's click, 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 click. And there's one on the clock on the stove, but that doesn't click, so that must be something different. And it's kind of a fascinating toy. Okay, right? You start out with that. And so you're curious about it, and so you start asking a few things about this toy. But, as a kid, what happens when you start playing with a toy for a while?
It breaks.
Or suppose it doesn't break, then what? You get tired of it, you get bored. Well, your other toys you were allowed to get bored with, but this one they didn't allow you to get bored with it. I mean, if you were bored, you still had to play with it, and it began to not be quite so much fun. Remember trying to figure out the difference between, say, 3:45 and 3:45. I mean, that was really I didn't want to play that game. But somehow this toy, something serious and all that. And then adults started saying strange things to you. Really strange things. Okay? Now, just imagine, here you are. You don't have any concept of time. Adult comes up to you. Adult's out there working. You come up to the adult and say, I'm hungry. Adult turns around and says, but it's only 4:30. What's 4:30? Oh, that's when the big hands on the 6 and the little hands between the 4 and the 5. At this point, if you ask a kid, you get their confidence. The kid doesn't have an answer. But the child knows that one rule, the first rule they learn, is you don't ask why 3 times in a row. Right? Have you ever experienced that? Why? Why? Third one. Why? And you feel this tension kind of building up in your stomach, and you feel, if you see that, because you know that they're stuck. You're stuck. And usually the kind of answer for the third why is because that's the way it is. Right? Right? Because that's the way it is. And you almost have to cut it off there because if you started with this 4:30 and the concept of time, and you just kind of encourage the child to ask questions, they start asking questions like, well, if time always goes on, how did it begin? Why don't you handle that one? I don't know how to handle those kinds of questions. Or how do we know it can't go backwards? You know? How do we really know that? And you'd find out that you would probably, that's the way it is, or don't ask silly childish questions. Which translated, and the child begins to realize that, they begin to forget it though when they grow older, is I really don't know, but you're not supposed to ask those kinds of questions. That's what the answer is. The answer is. Okay. Not supposed to do that. That fit? Does that fit experience both as a child that you had and as an adult as you've responded to child, children? That fit? Okay, now did you go back later as you grew up and you began to know how to read clocks and so forth? Did you get together with people and discuss the nature of this thing called time? Have you spent much time doing that? See, I have a hard time even, you notice how many times I use the word time in so many different ways. Have you done that? You do that very often? It's a very difficult concept to come, like the modern scientists come up with things and they talk about how time is relative. What does that mean? And this person goes out into space and if they go at a very high velocity, they come back at a different age. And that all sounds strange. All sounds strange to me. So the concept of time, we basically learned, how did we learn it? Well, we learned it, it's primarily as a disciplinary device. For example, I remember, it's 9 o'clock, he says, it's 9 o'clock, you're supposed to be in bed. Well, I'm supposed to be in bed at 8. That's what they said. Now I'm in trouble because this little hand's pointing at the 9 instead of the 8. How come the clock isn't early? How come I have to be the one that's late? Why don't they get mad at the clock instead of me? I'm not tired. No way, no way. I mean, you'd never get anywhere with a kid arguing with a parent that way. What would happen? The parent pulls rank, okay? You're in bed because I said so. You get in bed. And that's it. You learned it as a disciplinary device. Oh, yes.
My 2-year-old always says 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, they learn real quick. Five more minutes. Now, I don't know what they mean, but I think what they really...
Sometimes it's 10 minutes.
I think what they've learned, though, is that might be a way of asking to continue doing what they're doing. Or not do something they want to do. They realize that somehow, and if they say 5 minutes, it's kind of a magical phrase that allows them to get away with something. Okay, I don't think they have any perception of what 5 minutes is. Later they do.
Well, okay. You can always turn to mom and dad as to why they don't understand the concept of 5 minutes. Because as we're getting ready to go somewhere, we say, okay, now, 5 minutes, we're going to go. Half an hour later, we go. Now think of the trick it puts the kid in when they're working on a paper in school and the teacher says, okay, you've got 5 minutes. And he goes, oh gee man, this is going to be slack.
Okay. But still, it's not, you're right. There's, but nevertheless, the parents become distressed then. So they say 5 minutes and it's a half an hour. And what happens? What's the nature of the social situation then? Tension, complete panic, the whole place is going apart. There's something serious in that hand moving. There's something really deadly serious in that. Okay, I notice it in the classroom, my students, you know, have an interesting topic, you know. It's coming near the end of the period and the clock's going out there and you can just all of a sudden notice the tension in the room and the people start folding up their books, you know, and they start looking up there. I said, the real one that really gets me, I says, I don't mind when they look at their watch, but when they put it up to their hand like this to see if it's still running, that really gets them. You know? And so, you know, it's something serious and all that. And in order to understand ourselves and the seriousness of all this, maybe it'd be a good idea to imagine that there's this visitor from another planet that comes down and observes us. See, it's very hard to really observe ourselves. Okay? It's like if you wear a pair of glasses, it's hard to, if you really need them. It's hard to see those glasses that you're looking through because you need them to see. If you take them off, you can't see. Okay. It's kind of, there's certain basic concepts that are that way, and time is one of them. Let's just imagine we have one more kid story. One of my kids had that was really strange. He described nursery school. And here's one description. He says, in nursery school, we'd all be playing at all sorts of things. All the kids were playing and having fun. Mr. Neal really liked what we were doing. He was a great teacher. We were having a great time. Then all of a sudden, Mr. Neal looks up at the clock on the wall. Then Mr. Neal changed. He began running around, putting things away and getting us ready. Everything changed. We couldn't get dressed fast enough, so Mr. Neal would do it. We couldn't keep up. And then we were all dressed, all bundled up. We didn't know anything. We just followed orders. Then the door opened, and all the parents were standing in the hall waiting. And there were some kids that actually believed that when they went to nursery school, the parents stayed there the whole time and waited. Or else, how would they all know when to come? Okay? Well, we tend to laugh at the kids, but now let's take a different perspective. We'll take a bright person from another planet, and they come down here, and they go on out, and they're observing what's going on. Fairly bright. And the first scene they see is there's this field out, beautiful field with a grass, nice thick grass, and blue sky with a few white clouds going by, and there's this lone tree out there, and there's a couple out there having a picnic. And you're just at enough of a distance to grasp the whole scene, and you can hear them laughing and joking around. And, it's a really beautiful scene, okay? I mean, you can see this. You can get the spirit of it. You can get into your mind. So you see this person kind of smiling at this, really, really enjoying this, something really, really important. Then all of a sudden, one of the people, looks at this device strapped to their bodies. They shout, "Oh my God!" And they jump up, grab their stuff, and run off. And oh my God, huh? You begin to take their statement quite literally. Okay? He writes that down in his notes, a visitor from another planet, and makes some similar observations. And here is a report that they wrote back after making some similar observations, a visitor from another planet. And I'll read the report to you from this visitor. Every clock is really the eye of a silent time god. The god's eye peers over the rooms that humans live and work within. Humans even keep a god's eye near their bedsides. They even strap god's eyes to their bodies. There is no escape or privacy from the god's eyes. When a human looks into the god's eye, stern and demanding stare must come forth. Yet to us, the God's eyes look harmless. We ourselves have never observed the God's use of force. It is the humans themselves who enforce the time God's demands. Humans rush together to meet the God's demands, often in such a mad frenzy they even kill themselves, either quickly, violently, or slowly. He's been in a traffic jam, you see, a rush. Yet it is the humans themselves who reprimand those who do not keep up with the God's demands. We have seen 1,000 people rush all at once to the same place. Then they work. Later, they all eat their lunches. Then they work some more. Then they all leave their work and rush en masse, which can be dangerous, to return to their homes. The next day, they repeat all this. But here is the really amazing part. None of these people needed to say, "Let's go to work," or "I feel like eating," or "Let's go home," or "Let's do it again." The time God silently spoke through its multiple eyes, and all but the privileged few, and the outcast leapt to its demands. Now, you think that would be an unreasonable assessment, an observation of how we behave? Not, probably not. There are other cultures we found that look at our concept of time, and they see it rather strange. In fact, we are modern technological societies, are one of few cultures that have the concept of time. The whole concept just doesn't exist in other societies, at least from what I'm told. It's hard for me to even imagine what it would be like imagining existence without the concept of time, but they do. In fact, they see our behavior as rather humorous. I worked in the southwest United States with the Pueblo Indians, and I went to several of the ceremonies that they had there, and one of the things you notice is that they have clowns as part of their rituals and part of their, the Hopis, the Kachinas, and they have clowns as part of the dancers, as part of the whole ceremony. And these clowns put on different antics, and they're really pretty funny. And guess what color they're painted? White, right? I don't know how far that goes back, whether that's a pre-Columbian tradition or not, or whether that's a recent addition, because they just saw so much that was funny with the whites. But anyhow, there's one scene that Frank Waters describes in his book, The Man Who Killed a Deer, and he is one of the best authors on Indian culture, one of the best non-Indian, he's not Indian himself, but he seems to have one of the best sensitivities towards this. And he describes one of these clowns with a big alarm clock. And he's dancing around doing stuff, and all of a sudden he looks at that clock and he says, "Time to be hungry," and he starts grabbing food from all the people. Everybody laughs. Everybody laughs. "Time to be tired," lays down, goes to sleep. Everybody laughs. Okay? It's ridiculous. And if you've ever been in the Southwest, and I don't know whether it's still true now, but they refer to Indian time. Indian time. I'll give you an example. Indian time, there was an announcement that said the celebration will begin at 4 o'clock Indian time. Well, there was a humor in that because there was a contradiction. 4 o'clock is not the way Indians do things. And at Indian time, there was another message. So I decided to show up at 4 o'clock. Of course, I was the only one there. But eventually, fairly soon, an announcer came, Navajo, and they had the PA system all set up, and it was announcing time for the announcer. I was the only one there. So he started making these announcements in Navajo, which I didn't understand, but it was announcing time for the announcer. He started making these announcements on and on. People started coming in and not paying a bit of attention to the announcements. But then there was greeting. People were greeting. And then eventually you begin to see this celebration happening. Now if you were to ask them, "Well, what time did the celebration begin?" It began at celebration time. As what time? Well, what's celebration time? Well, you have greeting time and meeting time and preparing time, and these merge into a kind of holistic celebration time. And then celebration time goes through a life cycle where it's evening time and fire time and dancing time and growing tired time and sleeping time. And then that evolves into the next day where the celebration reemerges again. And the whole celebration emerges into year time and season time and into lifetime. And it says, clock time, what's so great about that? You got these silly little hands pointing at numbers. Should celebration, something as important as celebration, fit the discipline of something as trivial as this ticking device with these arms fitting on the numbers?
Dave, I have a question about, to me, there seems to be a relation between time or clocks and the movement of the sun and the length of the day. And so that's, I don't know if you're talking about that.
There are certain regularities in nature. That's true. One of them, the rotation of the earth. Now, scientists tell us that the rotation of the earth is getting the day, average day is getting longer. That's one of the things. How do they know that?
Heard it on the radio last week.
How'd they calculate that? I mean, if an hour, yeah, but if an hour is defined as 1/24th of the rotation of the Earth, now how can you tell that the rotation of the Earth is getting longer or shorter? I don't know which one it was. How do you do that? What scale do you use? Yeah, but you got to calibrate the clock to something. I mean, you calibrate them to each other, but eventually there has to be some standard, right?
Yeah. Yes, there is an answer. Yes. And the answer is in the accumulation of things through a period of a day or a year. And in studying the fossils of as much as 400 million years ago, we can find that the daily accumulation of lime in a shell can be measured. And so through time, you can actually measure the length and time of whether the day was longer or shorter, whether the year was longer.
Well, my understanding of how they've done that, though, is they've defined the standard second by the oscillation of the cesium-133 atom, okay, an isotope, radioactive isotope. Now, why would they do such a thing as that? I mean, that would be what a people would come up to you and say, why is the oscillation of the cesium, does anybody here know what the cesium-133 atom is? And it's a rather sophisticated mathematical approach to go ahead and figure out the standard second. What's so important about that?
You never hit the moon.
Are you waiting for a devil's advocate here?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
First of all, I grant you that living by the clock is a sickness of our society.
Oh, I didn't say that.
I'll say that. But can you imagine, I mean, I see time as having sociological and scientific implications. Can you imagine getting a new product that we have to mix together and you stir it for 30 seconds and then things happen to it? If we didn't have this concept of time in our technology, we couldn't function in our technology without time.
Okay,
scientifically, we couldn't function.
So time allows us to...
We need to find either Maurice or Bob Lander.
In the lapidary shop. Oh, they're in the lapidary shop. Okay. At least they were about 10 minutes ago.
Okay, our clock time allows us to solve problems. Okay, in a controlled way. Okay? And in a precise way. Okay? It allows us to do that. That's true. That's
and
true.
The other thing, sociologically, what happens if you don't have time and, we have these things called restaurants and things, and all the people decide to get hungry at 10 o'clock. And so everybody in Yakima shows up at one restaurant at 10 o'clock. It does, I mean,
I thought you were going to go the reverse. What happens if you try and start up a factory and everybody comes at different times?
That's the other...
So we need, it provides some order. Okay, it provides some order. Well, I think it provides order to get together, because I think there were plenty, let's not be unfair to the non-technological societies. They did get together as communities, but we can do this in a more orderly way. Okay, and certainly in our society that would be true. Okay? Okay, you'd miss the boat. You'd miss out. Okay. Okay. So you've got precise order. That's back to the order again. Precise order. Okay. So let's pursue on that. what we do get from that.
Should be efficient if productivity is.
Okay. Now we got two other words.
Productivity can even be, learning things. I mean, we think of it as technological and it's producing product, but how would we learn about this lecture? Like, if there weren't time, we wouldn't be able to learn about revelations and time in the chaos.
Okay.
We couldn't learn so much.
So back to the order that we have. Now, I'm not sure it'd be chaos. I'm not sure it'd be chaos in the sense that we got
to get his luggage.
Okay, the point is, we Now, we do need that for our order in our society. That's true. But I want to get at this concept now. We'll get back, and I think we're kind of going around what you were getting at. Let's take this concept of efficiency. Let's refer it to our own time now, and we say, use time efficiently. What does that mean? Let's examine. I'm not saying that it's wrong. I say, let's be clear about what our concept of time means. When I say, use time efficiency, efficiently, what does that mean?
You have to be productive.
Oh, okay, wait a minute. But let's just get this. This is very interesting, because when we say use time, that's different than me saying use wood, use coal, use metal. When I say time is a resource, I'm speaking of it differently than when I'm speaking of coal. When I say use coal efficiently, that means put it in a burner so that you can get more heat out. When I say use time efficiently, what does that mean to you? When I say use time, use your time efficiently.
I don't see that as being different.
Well, what does it mean to you when I say use time efficiently?
It means put yourself into it.
Ah, put yourself, get yourself going.
Make every minute count.
Make every minute count. Go a little bit faster. Do a little bit more. Okay, but consuming time is a little different though than say consuming coal. Do you have, you know, consume coal, you got less of it when you're done. You can stack up coal and store it. You can take the firewood and pile it up out there. You can't do that with time. You can't pile it up. Saving time doesn't mean that. Okay? The point you raised is when we speak of using time, we're referring to our own activities. We're not talking about something that we can grab hold to. I'm going to use this thing. You see? So it is really back to what we learned as a child, you see. It is kind of a shaping of our own behavior that's involved. And when we say, be efficient, use your time efficiently, be productive, use your time productively, we're talking about our own behaviors. And the point I think people are raising is we've built the world with ships and boats going down Lake Chelan and cars and lights switching on, that if people didn't shape their time that way, it wouldn't work that way. Okay? Okay? Does that fit the experience? Now, kids learn that by, at first this doesn't make any sense to them when they say, use your time efficiently. You're talking about, what does that mean? Pretty soon they begin to get the word that that's a message about their own behavior. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, we had a forum on this at one time when we invited the poet, the theologian, the scientist, and the technologist to just kind of be a panel. And the poet really takes a very different point of view of time. Time means nothing except to the poet in terms only of life and death. Mm-hmm. Death is the only point in time that's really relevant. Mm-hmm. Everything else flows.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
And to the non-technical, non-scientific person, time has a very different kind of meaning, as well as to the unchild.
And we learn this also in the way that words are used. Like, you're right, the poet is different. Okay, now what happens in a technical world where we say, oh, he or she's a poet? What does that phrase mean quite often? You say,
it's freer.
Nonconformist.
It goes broke. Generally, in a technical society, that's kind of a put down. That is. And that means that the person is not solving problems in an analytical way, is not controlled, or doing something that allows you to control, is not being precise, is not being orderly in the usual technological way of order, and is not being efficient or productive, and the poet would say, you're darn right I'm not. Right? I mean, the poet wants to say something. Can they be precise? Let's just take that. Precise? Can they give you a precise definition of what they're trying to say? I mean, can you give a precise definition of love, or trust, forgiveness, or grace? Any of those? Are those shaped by control, precision, order, efficiency, productivity? Okay?
No, but they're best expressed by the poet.
They're best expressed by the poet. But in a technological society, see, what a technological society
And this is why we use clocks and why we have time. And we need them. That's true. Technological society is one in which these things that we've mentioned have prominent and pervasive and persistent importance in the interactions of people.
And it also reflects our, I think our faith has something to say to that, because we're called to love people and to be concerned about sharing the gospel. We can't always control that or be precise about that or see any efficiency or productivity.
That's right. That's right. It doesn't fit so much. You see, another one is, of course, objective. You know, you want to have objective control and precision, so objectivity. And that means you're supposed to stand outside it and look. And that's why a clock, of course, is objective in the sense it doesn't, its behavior doesn't depend at all on you. You see? I mean, you run a simple experiment on that, just stand in front of the clock and see what you can do about it. I mean, it keeps going, you smash it, of course. But then that would be losing self-control, and then you'd be destroying the instrument. Well, the word gospel means a story to get involved in. I mean, you can't know the gospel as the detached observer, right? And you can't know that, okay? Now, the point I'm raising is that in our day-to-day behavior in the use of clocks, what we're expressing are certain common background expectations, behaviors that occur in a technological society. These, you might want to call them values, but that would be a whole other discussion. Let's just say, all right, they are values for the time being. There are certain values that pervasively and persistently are held to be important in a technological society. Solving problems, control, precision, order, efficiency, productivity, and objectivity. These are the kinds of things that are held in common. And they're taken for granted so much by us that we look at this watch and we never think about why we're doing that and why another culture might not have. You see, another culture might not have done that because these weren't particularly important values for that culture. Involvement, for example, might have been more important than objectivity. Poetry might have been more important than precise calculations and order. Care might be much more important than control.
But how about consideration for the other person? If I didn't look at my watch and know that it was around 11:45, mm-hmm. I let my kids stay in Narnia and let the poor person take them all day. Not give a damn when he's so tired.
You're right. And I'm not saying the clock is wrong.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not saying the clock.
Consideration seems like a caring thing.
That's right. But we have to behave that way because we've structured a society and structured the arrangement based upon the clock, and which is based upon these values. Now, I'm not saying that that's wrong. What I'm saying is we have to be aware that that's what we've really done. And if we want to understand another society, say a third world country, or we want to understand the Bible, okay, we have to come to grips with the kinds of things that we take for granted. Okay? And what we tend to take for granted is the importance of solving problems, control, precision, order, efficiency, productivity, objectivity, and those kinds of things. We take that as being important, not because we have them written down as Ten Commandments. No, there's a more fundamental way that we take them as important. We take them for granted. They are obvious to us. Our order, our society is structured around them. You have to do it that way or you're left out. That's how we accept those values. And they're reinforced in us day in and day out. And our language is shaped by that. For example, let's take one word. Okay? Let's take communications. Okay? Now the word communication, okay? The word communication is used quite often in today's society. Okay? We speak of the communications revolution. Right? I mean, you've heard that. A tremendous advancements in communications, we say. Okay? And why is that? Television, the microprocessor, right? You get computers, shift information around. Okay? And the speed and volume of information transfer has increased tremendously. Everybody agree with that? And we call this an advance in communications. Okay? Everybody see that? Now, what I suggest to you is there has to be something else that we're not looking at because we're tending to think this way. Why do we call that an advance? Let's bring our visitor in from the other planet and see what they might say. I'm not saying that they're right. It's just that they're different. And when they're different, that tells us something about ourselves. Or we've just announced to this person from another planet about our tremendous advances in the communications. Okay? We talk about satellites and TV, and you can get all this information flowing, and you can go ahead and you can do all this stuff. What an advancement. We've just told them that. And now we're going to see their reaction. Here's their reaction. What have you done to the word communication? I'll tell you, you've separated it from the word community and even from the word communion, which many of you hold to be a sacrament. You have purged care, participation, and belonging out of the meaning of the word. For you, communication no longer carries these meanings. Now the word means information transfer, and the advance that you so shallowly claim involves the efficiency of information transfer. Your advance involves the speed and volume of information bits transferred. I'll tell you what I see in your so-called communication advance. I see people sitting in front of a box for 4 to 8 hours a day, silently absorbing the antics of non-existent people, actors and celebrities, who don't even know that they're watching. You call it an advance because more and more people can do this kind of thing. But you fail to see how you've shaped the word communication itself to fit your technological expectations. Those. When I tell you your communication is careless, you don't even know what I mean. You think I mean disorderly, imprecise, inefficient, not planned. No, I don't mean that. Your communication is careless because care itself has been purged from the word. Participating and belonging care as a parent and child should care has been purged. You think that I am quibbling with words. Let me tell you, a word is more than a mere definition. A word is a state of being uttered from one who is acting out its meaning. Okay? Now what I'm trying to get on this is not that we're bad and they're good. I'm trying to push us to accept that while this has many good features to it, the good and the bad are mixed together. Paul Tillich refers to the demonic. Now there is a word that is non-technological. Okay, demonic. We tend to think of these demons with horns and pitchforks running around. What could be that's certainly not an objective and precise description of anything. And Tillich would say, yes, that's true, but let's see what the word demonic means. And he says the demonic is something always associated with the good. And it's where a means or a vehicle to goodness becomes overextended until it becomes the definition of goodness itself. Okay? A vehicle for goodness becomes overextended until it becomes the definition of goodness itself, and then it becomes its opposite. Efficiency isn't bad. Certainly efficiency in terms of hospital care, certainly that is a means to goodness. Care for people. But how often is efficiency held up as a value in itself? In our language and our actions, there is what Tillich would call a demonic. We're a means to goodness, being efficient, being precise. Okay, that becomes the definition of something good. And if you can't measure it, you can't be precise about it, and you're inefficient, you're being bad. That's not right. That would be the indicator of the demonic. Now, my reason in bringing this up, these words, is because these words represent, to a large extent, how we think, how our language, what our language means, what our concepts are, time, the word communication. And that's important for us to recognize.
Because when we recognize that that's how we behave through our actions, then we possibly aren't going to be quite as dominated by that. We can say, we're more than that. Okay? We're called to be more than that. And we can really mean it and still recognize how much we tend to get trapped by this. Okay? So that's my reason behind looking at a concept like tongue. Other cultures didn't share that. We share that concept of time because we hold these values to be important. No, they're not written down as commandments, and they're not preached in pulpits. But more than that, they're practiced day in and day out in the day-to-day things we do, and that's how values get reinforced. And you're right. If we don't practice these kinds of things, we get left out. We get in trouble. We get someone else in trouble. You're right. That's how we learn time as a kid. We got in trouble. Or we got someone else in trouble. Or we caused frustration. That's how we learn the importance of control, precision, order, efficiency, productivity, and objectivity. That's how we learned it.
I think it has a lot to do with the kind of image we have of ourselves. We live in a culture
Definitely.
Where if you can get a PhD, or you can get a job that gives you some kind of gives you a rating in our society, but there's certain things that we are unable to rate, and thus people who can do some of those things can't really appreciate the value that people who are able to love and care and be compassionate, there's no way of rating that or of saying that they're productive or efficient, but that's what the gospel calls us to do. And so that, I think, is part of the struggle in my life, because I went to a university where everyone was going to get a PhD, and that was success for them. And I realized that I wasn't called to that kind of
profession,
that the gospel called me to something different, and it meant to be caring and loving. But how do you rate that? How do you...
We don't really rate it.
We can't do that, so we just have to be able to accept that. And when we accept that, then that kind of frees you from the binds that our culture puts on us.
Yeah, it sort of frees us. We're not always, of course, none of us are totally free from the culture we're in. That's why we have to relate to other people. I mean, because, you know, we're a part of it. But you're right, it does put us in a bind. How do you rate? You know, and this is part of how do you get an objective and precise order for the importance of things. You see, it's back to those values again. Now, people have tried to go ahead and take different jobs and rate them. We have a sociologist, a feminist sociologist on campus, and she's found some of these ratings. And you take the ratings of, say, like child caring for children. Okay. Now, that doesn't fit. I mean, you can't do this in a nice, precise way. I mean, all you have to do is be in a bunch of little kids and precision and objectivity and being a detached observer. And so she pointed out that child care is rated somewhat below animal training. And she found out. Because you see, you can be more precise and orderly and efficient probably when you're training with animals. Okay? And that's true for a lot of the jobs that we have in society that they have received a lower status. But the gospel, of course, says, well, don't be surprised if that's true. That's one of the things the gospel has. Now, I think what we have to do as Christians is we have to examine the meanings of words that we share, because they reflect perceptions and pressures placed upon us. And we have to live in this society. We can't just abandon this. But to come to grips with that, we're going to have to rescue certain words. I mentioned the word communication. We can't just accept that communication means information transfer. And that's what we're really told. That's what really comes through. We cannot accept that. There are other words like myth. The word myth in this means phony. Okay? Phony story, pumped up story. You can look it up in the Dictionary of Thesaurus, and that's what it'll tell you. Well, maybe myth is a form of knowledge that it can't be precise, and it can't have objectivity, and you analyze it the way you would an engineering structure. Maybe it's because it deals with a kind of knowledge that's higher, that transcends these commitments, which I hear you saying. Okay. The word faith. Does faith mean belief with a low level of objective evidence? I hope it means more than that. But that's how we tend to take it.
We have a low level of objective evidence, precise and orderly evidence, and so we impose our willpower, and we call that faith. Okay. Well, maybe faith means something more than that. I certainly hope so. So I think the role of the Christian, we have to live in this world, that's true, and we're saved by that. But we can't be totally dominated by that, and that means that we have to come to grips with what this is. And we have to recognize the limitations of this. And we have to treat it as a gift, but we also have to recognize its power and the way we can be seduced by it. And then I think we're in a stage of time when we have to really start trying to rescue words. Like the books we're holding now, the one by Fox on compassion, and how that word has to be rescued because the word has changed. The word faith, the word hope. I find these students, we discuss problems, and if I can't come up with a solution, they say I'm being hopeless. That's hopeless. Oh, is hope supposed to come out of this? You'd be surprised how many times that's what happens. So, this is kind of what I see I want to try in the next week in terms of technology and theology dialogue. It's not that technology is bad. Technology is going to be, these kinds of values that we hold. And they shape our language, they shape the ways we behave, they shape our relationships. And yet, as Christians, we are called, and it is a non-technological word, to be called. What does that mean? Okay. We are called to be more than that. I think non-Christians are called to be more than that, too. We're called by God to be more than that. And what that means in our technological world is something we have to struggle with. And that means that we as a culture have to struggle with the limitations of what we do very well. And what we do as a culture very well is technology. We do. As a Western culture, we do that very well and look around at the changes that have occurred. But what that means is we also have to say, what is the risk in doing that well? How do we get trapped by doing the very thing that we're doing well? And that's what we have to come to grips with. And that's why I think the study of technology and theology really belongs together. I mean, it really belongs together. Okay, now, any comments? I just think I'm, yes.
A good illustration was, Megan Stiller was having his yard landscape, and the landscaper had four guys out there, and they were out there landscaping and landscaping all yesterday. And one day he only had three, and I remarked, hey, you know, you're not going to get finished in time, you know, and have three workers out here. But they spent a couple of days, and he only had three. And he said, well, no, one of our workers is not still up. And I said, what do you mean you show up? Well, he just didn't show up to work today. He probably had enough money for a while, and he didn't show up. And I said, hey, he's not a very good worker, is he? And he said, no, that's not true. He actually is one of my better workers. He said, he's Navajo. And he said, on the days when he has enough money, you know, there's really no reason for going to work. And so he used to go to spend the money. Days on end before, you know, he doesn't come to work, and finally he runs out, he'll come back to work. But it's kind of interesting in the fact that his boss didn't consider him one of his poor employees, but one of his better employees. It's just that you know, took account for this when he saved his job.
He was probably lucky to have a boss like that. So the first thing that we do when a person or a group of people do not hold these as paramount, they call them unreliable, incompetent, inefficient. They call them those. And I would suspect that a lot of employers call the Navajo back by those terms. Now, interesting contrast while you're on that, spending the money and earning the money. John Kenneth Galbraith in his book wrote that the family structure that we've evolved in America and the sexism role that we put is that the woman's role was to spend the money and the man was to make it. And you have to manage the consumption, and that in a technological society you've got so many things that you need a full-time manager to do it. But you can't grant that full-time manager who's taking care of the children and stuff too much status because it doesn't fit this stuff too well. So you end up having this, out of a technological society, you almost have to have, according to this thing, the concept of the woman being in kind of the subservient role because she obviously has to care for the kids, and she can't be real precise and objective doing that all the time. But if we give her equal status, then we're degrading these kinds of things, and the technological society won't be able to function. Well, you think that that's a weird view. If you've read Wealth and Poverty by George Gilbert, you will see that this is the book for the present administration. You'll see that that is primarily the role of the family, is to get the man to be productive. That's the primary role, and productive means doing this. And they do that by having the woman depend upon him and the children. Okay? And he comes right out and says that. So the Navajo was saying, I'll spend and do this as one person. So in a sense, the Navajo is being a little more integrated than maybe we are. Somebody else had this thing.
Up there? I think you have a hand off.
No, go ahead.
Just one little story. We had a friend in Cameroon who told the story of his colleague receiving a telegram that he should get somewhere else about as quickly as he can. And so he set the train schedule, jumped into his Land Rover, and bounced on down to the train station at Ngara Dere. The train was just pulling out of the station, so he started pursuing it, and the conductor yelled at him and said, "Take your time, lots of time. Take your time. This is yesterday's train."
Now, the interesting question that would come after this is, why did we laugh at that? Okay? Now, obviously, it made sense to the person who said that, or somehow, you know. And humor, quite often, is behavior which is basically honest, but doesn't fit this. It didn't fit the order, the proper order, to when the guy was saying it. And so we find that humorous. We find children cute quite often because they don't do these things. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult to be a teenager is because you're big enough now, you're supposed to do these things the right way, and you're no longer cute when you don't know, but you haven't adapted quite enough to practice to do these things. So showing up late is not cute, and asking those questions is not cute. So teenagers have a hard time. But some more stories. I would say, and it'd be interesting to reflect on this, is that those groups of our subcultures who aren't as much dominated by this generally are economically in low status. And that would include minorities and many women who in the home, raising children, you're going to be precise and objective and all of this. Obviously there's got to be a lot really crazy. You're going to run it like a computer. So there probably is a basis of prejudice that does occur, is where people don't do these things as well, that in a technological society, there will be a lower status and a lower income associated with that. In general.
I always find it funny, I have to say, that people walk around saying they don't have enough time when they all have the same amount of time. And they really do the same. I'm not used to efficient amount of use my time. For my own, my biggest thing, I don't have enough time to get there. I'm not using their time
Or the demands being placed upon them are increasing so rapidly that they cannot keep up.
I don't think it is that we don't use the time efficiently. I feel I do. But you get so involved in different things and caring about other people. You get so involved with those things because you don't have time to do it. All the more things you like to do.
And it's an ironical thing, though, that in a society with all of the time-saving devices that we have, that the complaint, "I don't have enough time," is more common here than in many, many other societies. And that's probably because the devices are more stressed towards increasing efficiency, control, and so forth, and that as you get more of those devices, you feel these demands placed more and more upon your own behavior. You feel an element.
There's another factor that has to do with the possibilities of
I think it would be very interesting, though, if we had a session on the topic of choice. But I think there is a difference between choice and decision. And I think this decision is blurred, and this distinction is blurred. And certainly in terms of quantities of decisions available to us and that forced upon us, they're expanding. Whether choice is or not, I'm not too sure. And that requires, I think, a broader concept. But anyhow, that would be an interesting one to pursue, the difference between choice and decision.
That's called value judgment.
Yes, but even that has a tendency, you know, what are values? And we tend to think of values as general principles which we can figure out. Other cultures don't think of it that way. So if you would open up a whole lot of different questions about what do we mean by values when we talk about choice and decision.
I'm wondering if there isn't some relationship between time and yield discussion and social complexness. Because I was sitting there trying to think about rural society, the ones that I witnessed and the kinds of things that you discussed with the Navajos and then the Cameroon seem to be prevalent in essentially rural societies, but yet in those same societies people are busy from morning to night. Working in the fields, or making baskets, fishing, cooking, eating. In the village societies that I've been in, people generally were not idly sitting around staring at trees. They were very busy, which means that they were organizing their day. But yet it was in the social interaction, particularly with Westerners, that he found it cute that they would say, I'll see you on Thursday, and then they'd show up Thursday a month later. They did show up on Thursday, but it just wasn't on time. So there seems to be some connection there between social complexity and time, as we described it here, and not that rural folks the world over don't have any concept of time or aren't productive anymore.
Yeah, the meaning of complexity, though, gets, that's a hard one. That's another one of those words that's very difficult to deal with. But you're right, in terms of these communities, from what I've read, is the social interaction kind of shapes what they do. And they can be very busy, so, but the concepts that they do it by are different, are very different.
I think some of the problems we have in our personal relationships too because of time. And I think the things that are laid on us, like the time to get married now, mm-hmm. or if you're widowed, there's a certain time that's acceptable before you go out. There's a time element between children that you're supposed to be successful. Even studies of we need so many minutes a day of quality time for us to feel good about ourselves. And I think we all have different expectations of the kind of time we need from other people, and we get into trouble.
Yeah, it can. And yet we need it at the same time. We can't just throw out the concept of time, and yet it could get us into trouble because we take too narrow a view that when we start speaking of time, we start structuring things this way. Okay, we have a tendency to do that because that is the character of time as we know it comes out of this. So we can't throw that out, but we may need to develop new ways of talking of those things so we're not so much dominated by these, but yet we can use them. Okay, here and then there.
Here's another thing too, isn't it? In a modern society, as opposed to the rural society, because of the communication, we have between all the different groups that we work with. I'm a member of a society which is my working society. I'm a supervisor. People work for me. I work for other people, etc. That's a society.
I'm also a member of the church. In fact, right now I'm kind of in transition between two churches. I was elder at one congregation. The same Sunday I was also going to a meeting with the Board of Education for the other congregation. Two separate societies. Each one of those managed my time. I'm also a member of my family. My family requires my time. I'm a member of that society. I'm also a member of the society of my neighborhood. My neighborhood has Willow Hills Association meetings, etc., etc. I'm also a member of the international community, and it's national in a sense that I get telephone calls. Hey, review this paper. Hey, do this, do that. I'm a member of the technical society. They demand my time. So all of these separate communities, if I was only a member of one, or if they were all the same, then everyone would understand how come I can't be here and here and here at the same time. That's a little problem.
It's a problem, that's true. I would say that you find, though, that in these different cultures, in our overall society, you find that the most pervasive and persistent kinds of behaviors between people are characterized by these kinds of things. And I find this certainly in your job, when you go into your job, it's very hard to integrate the church language into that. It and honestly is, and yet you can integrate this into the church, the behavior structure of the church organization. Anyhow, that'd be a different topic. But you're right, there's a lot of conflicting pressures here. Yes?
Well, just to mention that I just made a time ago.
Yeah. you can notice how it
is. You didn't have a reaction to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is that time in our concept is finite. There is a finiteness to it. It starts at one point and ends at another. Other cultures view time as eternal. There is no beginning of time and no end of time. And so if you perceive time in these two different ways, you can come up with very different judgments of how you use it. Mahayana, don't worry about things. If you don't get them done on time, there's always another day. Time is not so limited.
Well, I found interesting that our concept of time, someone mentioned it before, is we have the future, which isn't yet in the past, and the infinitesimal small now where everything is supposed to exist. Well, how does music exist at a point? Okay, how does it exist? How can you speak at love at a point? And what happens, I think, when we think of reality existing at a point in time, music, love, trust, these things which you can't talk about at a point in time, somehow they become less real to us than objects and matter. So it affects the way we think.